What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Go Loud. AI Magnified, brought to you by Go Loud and proudly sponsored by Fitzgerald Power. Adding value always. FitzgeraldPower.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to this, our second episode of our special series of Magnified, which we're calling Magnified Plus, where I'm not doing interviews with individuals about their careers, but instead we've picked a subject. In this case, it's artificial intelligence, which we're examining in the company of people who really know their stuff. And I'm delighted that this series is proudly sponsored by Fitzgerald Power, a firm that thrives on creating the best accountancy service to its clients using technology, industry insights, and innovative solutions. Fitzgerald Power helps businesses unlock their full potential and make more informed decisions. Now, our second episode today is going to focus on changes within businesses, the challenges that companies face about how they go about their work because of AI, and what this demands of workers and what it demands of the managers of companies. But it's not just the challenges, it's the opportunities as well. So we have two guests with us today for this, Brona Reardon and Lawrence Fessy. And Brona is analytics and AI leader and board chair at Cedar and a member of Ireland's AI Advisory Council. And she's got a range of jobs in data and analytics with some really interesting companies, including Cartrawler and Primark. And she also worked with Deutsche Bank. Lawrence Fessy is a part of SIA Partners. SIA Partners acquired his company Pathfinder back in 2020, and he looks at business transformation practice and has significant experience delivering major technology and transformation programs across a range of industries. Thank you both very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Matt.
I want to start with you, Lawrence, because recently SIA Partners launched a really fascinating study, I think, which was done using AI, looking at all sorts of industries across the world and making predictions as to how they're going to be changed working practices because of Gen AI in particular. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Sure. A lot of myths and scare stories can happen about what's the impact of AI. So we tried to put a bit of evidence underneath it to see what it might actually be. So our study focused on 50 different job occupations, okay, across a range of industries, and we looked at the to make a distinction between a job and the tasks or the activities that make up a job, okay, because they're kind of two different things, okay. So what we analysed it was if you take any particular job description, you know, you have what are you responsible for, who do you report to. And then what does your role involve? Okay, so if it's an accountant, it'll involve, either accounts payable, processing these, it'll involve kind of monthly returns or whatever it is like that. So by breaking down all of those tasks, we analysed what was their likelihood to be either significantly impacted by AI, medium or low impact by AI. And then based on that, then kind of rolled it up then to see what those job types might be in terms of impact, impact on AI in that job type. So what we found was that about 30% of all roles are going to have some level of impact, okay? A smaller quantity, about maybe 20%, will be significantly impacted by them, in the region of 80%. So that has interesting implications, that there's an opportunity for a lot of the routine type of work over time to be automated, replaced with an AI assistant, and that's going to free up time for those particular roles to either take on other stuff, okay, or to be consolidated. So
listening to that are likely to fear, they're going to say, hold on a second, freed up my time to do other things, but in time the AI will do those other things, and eventually, and maybe not even eventually, quite quickly, I'll be replaced by the AI.
And that's the default reaction, okay? So when I started my career about 30 years ago, there was a typing pool in my firm.
What was the typing pool?
The typing pool, exactly. And there were typewriters. There weren't even word processing, okay?
Okay, I'm being facetious because I started work on a typewriter as well before I got
absolutely
to a WordPress.
So the people that worked in those roles, there's no firm that I'm aware of nowadays to have a typing pool. But there's lots of firms have senior executive assistants who do a range and range of work. Probably those people that worked in that role are playing a similar role in there today. A lot more complex, probably a lot more interesting, also probably much better paid than they would have had the equivalent role 30 years ago. So we see there's lots of opportunities, and I'll talk a little bit more maybe later on, but we ultimately think that Gen AI will be an assistant rather than a replacement.
Do you agree with that, Brona?
I think it's very sensible, absolutely, to look at the opportunities. I think demystification is really important for society at the moment, and wonderful that you're focusing on this podcast to do so. I think there are many more opportunities than not, really. I think the key very much is, yes, absolutely, there's a role in automating routine tasks, for sure, but there will always be need for human involvement, and certainly AI is not at a stage yet where it will replace humans, certainly,
yet,
in my view.
But isn't that, again, the fear that many people have? It's yet, but it's moving at such a pace, and particularly with generative AI. I mean, we've had artificial intelligence involvement in lots of things for a while, but generative AI is moving at such a pace that it will take over from humans, or will it?
I think that's a long way to go, certainly, in my opinion. And I think the key would be very much trying to understand how to utilise AI today to best advantage to businesses. So how does that align with your strategic objectives? What are the opportunities? What are the opportunities to align with employees and humans and intelligence as well? So I think there's interesting fact around looking at what tasks can be automated, but also then what does that free up time for people to do? So one example is where you bring in augmented decision making, where the AI tool may predict something or deliver real-time insights, and then it's up to the employee or the human to understand how best to interpret that and make decisions based, for example, in real time to advance their business positively as well.
I don't want to go back too much over what we did last week in the first episode, but it does strike me at times is that, can you predict the future based on what happened in the past? Because so many unexpected variables come into every piece of life. And then you start using sort of augmented decision making, do things, and they don't work out because something unexpected happens.
That's a really good point, actually, to explain why you need human involvement. So certainly predictive analytics in and of itself has been around for quite a long time, actually. So a relatable example may be predicting sales for next week or next month. And certainly historical information and trends have been utilized to create that prediction. That is where humans will come in, understand what the output is saying. Are there any additional elements that need to be considered that haven't happened in the past? So that's exactly a really wonderful opportunity where AI and humans work together.
Well, let me just use a concrete example that just comes to mind. But Lawrence and myself are sitting here wearing shirts without ties. Now, it could have been, say, 10 years ago when men went to any work thing, they were wearing ties in office jobs. You could have used all the data prediction, say, in a retailer to predict what type of ties would be sold in the following year, what styles, what volumes, whatever. And who would have thought that actually ties would suddenly go out of fashion, that they weren't been worn at all? Yeah. Who could have predicted that?
I think that's where you can utilise AI in many ways, in real time actually as well. So there's a lot of information you can utilise looking at trends in the social network area, for example, and understanding what's happening in real time, not just historically as well. I think a really important point there is to understand when you're training models to make sure that it's fair and it's unbiased. So you need to ensure you've got a really good representative data that feeds the model to ensure that the outcomes are satisfactory and appropriate.
See, Lawrence, the jobs that you studied in the SIA Partners study, which I looked at, things like hospitality, healthcare, engineering, manufacturing, legal, education, finance, the creative industries, is there anything left that's going to be untouched by AI?
So I mean, give you an example of education. So my oldest son is a musician. He's done all the performance stuff, but he's also doing a master's in education teaching. So part of his coursework was prepare a number of personas of different types of students you might be teaching. Okay? So he could do it manually, right, go through, okay, well, we've got this student called Matt, who is brilliant on guitar, and he wants to go and learn this type of direction. Brona, who is very interested in classical violin, okay, and Lawrence, who'd love to play the saxophone, okay, and so on, and so on. And said, oh, I have to generate 50 Ds. I want to have a large variety. So he got ChatGPT to generate all of those personas. Okay, now, that output, he still has to work with it then in terms of developing training plans. But that just cut out a bunch of stuff, as far as he was concerned, was laborious.
Now, time saving.
Time saving.
But did it improve accuracy of what he was doing?
So then the second part, which Brona touched on, you then need to review that output because you can't take it uncritically. So there's kind of two parts. One is you have to ask good questions. Two, you have to have a level of critical thinking to look at what comes back. And critical thinking in many ways is a skill that has diminished significantly, probably over the last generation in particular. So there's far too much of a tendency to believe everything that you read on your last social media post, what people see on the internet. We see that in all of the kind of discourse on politics and so on at the moment, unfortunately. So you can't just take the output from any Gen AI engine as being the answer. Okay, Brona said it's as good as the quality of data that it's been trained on. There is still an element of bias, okay, in terms of what it's been trained on. In some areas like HR, a lot of the CVs it's been trained on were predominantly male, predominantly white from a particular demographic. That is not a good basis for looking at skills across a range of different sectors and so on. So, you know, it's an assistant, but you have to know how to work with that assistant, and you have to be able to take on board, criticize it, think about it, and then you add to it yourself your own particular value.
So you say it's an assistant. It strikes me that you can have all sorts of definitions for AI, artificial intelligence, augmented intelligence. So is it now assistive intelligence?
Yeah, potentially you could have that too, you know. But you still need to ultimately remember that the intelligence is probably still a more small I than a capital I, okay? And, you know, I don't think people should get intimidated by the word intelligence as part of that, right? It's still got a long way to go before it's going to reach the type of imagination that people can bring.
Brona, are we in danger of exaggerating what AI can do? Because I was talking to an engineer recently, a PhD involved in aviation, and he was, to a certain degree, dismissive of artificial intelligence as saying this is just a fancy way of expressing data analytics that we've been doing for quite a long time in all sorts of work.
It's a really good question, actually. And certainly this area of expertise has been around for a long time. It may have been called statistics, predictive analytics, data mining, data science, artificial intelligence. And now there's a new variation in generative AI. So it's certainly not a new concept as such. And I think there is an opportunity here. It's great to have the discussion and for businesses to not be scared of it, because the last couple of years have certainly focused on the new models and Gen AI, etc. However, the key is really to understand what is applicable to your business. How can you use this range of techniques, tools, technologies, methodologies to apply to your own business goals? So I think there's definitely a level of AI literacy, a need for skills and education across the whole spectrum of businesses as well, so that there isn't that fear about what's coming next.
Now, perhaps I didn't do enough of this with Patricia and John last week and asking for definitions of generative AI and the difference between the artificial intelligence, which, whether we realise it or not, has become part of our lives. So what difference is generative AI?
Generative AI, essentially, in a very simple way, it's about creating new content. And I think maybe a lot of people will have used ChatGPT. You can, add additional prompts and it'll come back with new content, perhaps that you haven't seen before. Whereas traditionally, people may have been understood AI and machine learning to look at maybe predictive analytics. So, like we said, predict sales in the next week, month, for example. It's a new variation on what's been there before as well. I think what makes it a little bit different is it's much more accessible now, and it's much more usable to the general public, where it's become much more...
And I think to add to Brona's point there, you know, I suppose the two key bits really that's described as additional to your, you know, classical AI has been natural language processing, which means very simply, instead of having to write computer code to get an answer of the data, you can ask a question the way you would ask a person a question, okay? And it can have a reasonably good interpretation of that. And the second thing has been the quantity of data that it's been trained on. And that's published data. So it's, you know, newspapers, it's books. There's a massive body of data where, A, it can, you know, populate its own memory around what's been said in the past, but it can also look to kind of correlate across different points of data and try to string an overall coherent story together.
Okay, let's come back to each of those. I'm fascinated. The first one, I'm sort of laughing at because I do remember when I did my BCom back in UCC in the 1980s, and we were required as part of our degree to do a year of computer science, and we were trying to write COBOL, and I hadn't a clue what I was doing. I have no idea how I managed to pass my computer science exams in second year because I was just bluffing entirely. And I look at even relatives of mine who were involved in writing computer coding. So are you saying that that is going to become, to a certain extent, redundant in the future?
Already with developers, there's very little development that starts from scratch. So once upon a time, I also did some programming once upon a time. So, but not, nowadays, no developer sits down and says, I need an algorithm to sort a list of data. There's a library somewhere that'll go and take that, okay? You know, nobody, you know, there's a load of different components, and the skill of developers nowadays is understanding what the overall design you want to do. You take building blocks that have been built by somebody before, been tested, okay? You know that they work, and the skill is around slotting them in, and you're much more focused then on either stuff around designing kind of new algorithms around, you know, which would be essentially a smart way to get this to the solution, as opposed to worrying about how do I craft the individual steps. So that's a big change already that's happening with developers. There's still a development skill. You still need to have an understanding of software, the testing process, how you release it and everything like that. But the amount of start with a blank page, like you would have with your old green line paper mat all those years ago, very little of that happens anymore.
Okay, and then the second point, Bruna, which was brought out there by Lawrence in relation to having this vast amount of data to draw upon. But then there are questions in relation as to whether you're entitled to that data or whether because certain people have put it behind a wall and other people have released it, if you're only getting partial data to work off.
Absolutely. And I think there are continuous discussions going on around access to data currently. I know a relevant point of discussion maybe as well around the recent EU AI Act as well. And that's a pivotal step in helping regulate AI, ensuring ethical AI, and also protecting fundamental rights. And I know that particular point is a discussion point that's ongoing in terms of access to data and how to do it in a fair, ethical and unbiased way as well.
Something that I hadn't thought of until I was actually just doing a little bit of research for this podcast was unauthorized use of AI, particularly by employees in a company, that apparently it's become a thing that sometimes workers are taking shortcuts that they're, even though they haven't been told to do so by their employer, are starting to use things like ChatGPT to make things easier or faster for them. But in doing that, could be uploading sensitive company data to ChatGPT and putting their own company to a degree at risk. Tell us a little bit more about this, Lawrence.
I think that is one of the key challenges for companies to really get serious about incorporating AI. So Bruna mentioned the regulatory bit, and we might talk about the act later, okay? But OpenAI, ChatGPT, these are all, you know, public available engines, okay? So they will consume data from where you get them, okay? To be really sensitive to your own company's sensitive information or intellectual property belonging to other parties, you really do need to be aware, where is that data going? So one of the implications longer term for companies that are going to be using it is probably to make sure that they're ring fencing and keeping those AI engines and their data purely within their company boundary. Okay, in the same way that for your normal IT security, okay, you don't let people access all of the files that you have in your SharePoint and everything like that. But there is a blind spot there in terms of awareness. And one of the other challenges is bring your own Gen AI on your phone or everything like that, okay? So that's one of the, I think, the big challenges for companies to understand is you can't have this as a free-for-all. It's a risk of damaging your own company's IP, and it's also a reputational risk around what does it mean around, you know, impacting other people.
Because I'm just thinking, for example, say a sales manager has to write a report, say in a retailer, and they get all of the company information that they have and ask ChatGPT to write up a report that they can make a presentation to their superiors on. But they've effectively uploaded confidential information from their company to ChatGPT.
Yeah, And certainly that's where companies need to take take some steps to ensure that that doesn't happen, that confidential information isn't uploaded. I know there was a report earlier in the year that identified, I think, 27% of shadow AI. So it's really important that one of the first steps actually businesses take when looking to implement and adopt AI is to carry out an audit of AI use cases currently happening across the organization. So what are people using it for? What are the use cases? What are the purposes? What data is being fed in? So there really needs to be a documented audit trail of what's happening currently.
So what did you call it? Shadow AI?
Shadow AI is a term that has been utilized for sure. And that maybe perhaps, hopefully not one of the examples that you'd shared, but it's really important that businesses know what employees are doing with AI, how they're using it and what data is being used. Certainly no confidential information should be shared.
But Bronagh, how much now of a challenge is this posing for managers and businesses, maybe even people listening to this and going, starting to feel a little bit overwhelmed by all of the things that they are been told they are going to have to do? We'll get to the potential benefits in a moment, but you did offer me a list of some of the key work practices that you believe businesses need to address. And you're particularly interested in smaller businesses through Cedar as well. So can you just maybe go through some of those things and we'll ask Lawrence to comment on them as well?
For sure, absolutely. I think one of the first places to start is to understand what your strategy might be. So where would you look to utilize AI to align with your business objectives? So that's really important that you've identified high value use cases to align with your strategic objectives. One thing I would say is start small, so that you're not going to get overwhelmed. Pick one or two use cases and develop a small proof of concept that will deliver and iterate quickly so you can understand the value that AI is delivering.
Give me an example. And I suppose I'm using retail because it's one, I suppose, that people can easily understand. Yeah. Even if they don't work in retail, they go and they buy things in shops or they buy them online.
One of the well-documented use cases, for example, in retail may be around that predicting sales element. And that's been a model that has been around for quite a number of years. So that's easily understandable and understood by employees. And that will be able to give you, say, depending on what you're asking for, sales next week, next month, next year. So what you need to do is educate your employees and your workforces as to how to utilize the outputs and the insights to make business decisions. So perhaps that's one example of where you might start.
Okay, I just want to come back in because I'm just suddenly thinking, say, for example, you took historical data of your sales of particular items going back over 25 years. And you might be able to, if you're, say, in a shop, or if you have a chain of shops, say which shops sell well on a Monday, some on a Wednesday, some on a Saturday. But would that not all necessarily have changed that information as online selling became more prevalent over that time? And even things like how COVID would have disrupted it. And since people started returning after COVID, that they go into work on different days, go to shops on different days. So might your long-term information be incorrect for what is actually happening in the near term?
Interesting. I think you've described the inputs that you'd feed into a predictive model as well. So you'd feed in all of that information in terms of day, week, year, you know, the customer demographic, location. So that's all the information that you'd feed in to make sure that the output is developed at a granular level to allow you to make those decisions at that level of detail. So you're describing what would go into the model itself. Another example, actually, a really good one is around customer experience, and everyone's very aware of chatbots or virtual assistants. That's another good example of where organizations maybe have started as well. And again, leading back to the opening comments around automating routine tasks, that's again where you maybe have a nice example of human and AI interaction. The AI might deliver the predictable routine tasks, and then the human will get involved in customer experience where the tasks are more complicated. So I think we're all probably pretty used to sort of virtual assistants at this.
So would that chatbot calm me down as I get into a row with it? Because my experience of using chatbots usually is when I have a complaint to make and I get more and more frustrated as I'm actually dealing with it.
And that's where the human comes in, I guess, and you need that empathy and the person-to-person interaction as well.
Yeah, because you advise a lot in this, Lawrence, to businesses as to what they need to introduce in generative AI, don't you?
We do. I'd agree with Brona that you do need to have a kind of a stage roadmap in terms of where you go. One of the things that companies face is that, you know, AI is a bit of a buzzword at the moment. Okay, so their board is probably saying to them, what are you doing in Gen AI? What's your strategy? How are you going to apply it? Okay, and, you know, that's a very reasonable question. you know, customers and suppliers might be proposing to do something similar, or they might be asking questions. So there is a little bit of a risk that you rush into trying to apply Gen AI without really being sure, well, what problem am I trying to fix? Okay, so that's the first thing. Second thing is maybe not having the full awareness as to, you know, how big technology it can be and how all-encompassing and pervasive it can be, right? Now, you can scare people away from it as you start to let them know, you know, you've got these type of risks or these type of issues to be managed, okay? So starting small and, you know, kind of Brona uses the case, use cases, I sometimes like to think, well, what's the problems you want to fix, okay? And if it's the right problem, a good problem, that's the place to start. If it's not a good problem and you're just doing something because it feels like a kind of something to do, you're not really going to learn from it. You're not really going to get much value out of it. So having kind of small focus things and doing it in an environment that is kind of ring-fenced. And what I mean by ring-fence is that your IT security team understand what data you're feeding into it, understand kind of what external access there is and so on. You've got a cohort of users who have had a basic education and understanding, you know, what the limitations are, what the strong points are, and have an element of training themselves to work effectively with it, okay? And then have a very measured output around, you know, we want to try this. We want to see, does it work? If it does work, you know, we've got some expectation we'd like to see. Is it hitting it or getting close to it? If it isn't, then kill it and then go a different type of a pilot, okay? Because there is an element of experimentation here. And experimentation isn't a bad thing in terms of trying out stuff here to see what works.
Presumably, there's also an expense involved in this as well. So you've got to do a cost-benefit analysis.
There is. And again, you know, being careful with starting small, there is the opportunity to do low scale, relatively low expense, okay, before you scale up fully to an enterprise-wide type of system, right? But if you jump straight into an enterprise system, you can spend as much money as you want to spend.
Yeah, because, Brona, then that raises the question for businesses of all sizes, whether they try and do it for themselves or whether they get third parties to do it for them.
So that's a great point as well in terms of how you start and whether you partner with an organization or you're looking at building custom models as well. And I think it depends, as Lauren says, and what's your business objectives, what is the problem you're trying to solve, and what does that look like in terms of a proof of concept, and is it better to bring in, depending if you have internal expertise yourself in your business or you need to partner with someone.
But what demands is this going to make on employees? Because we were talking earlier about how they mightn't be required to do things that they used to do because it'll be replaced by AI and generative AI. But there may be times now that they're required to apply it themselves. But what sort of skills are they going to need to be able to do that?
That's a great question as well. And I think skills and education is really important. And actually, everyone across the business needs to have a certain level of literacy, right from leadership to management to employees, and understanding how it pertains to their role and what that means. So I think, one, we need to have a wide-scale literacy in terms of the opportunities and challenges and benefits, how that aligns to your business. Then there's an element of scaling up the technical staff that you may have in the organization, but also non-technical staff to understand how you're going to interact with the AI, how to use the outputs. And people, again, need to build up trust around AI outputs as well. So I think, like Lawrence mentioned as well, around sharing success stories, sharing the metrics, help people understand how it's going to benefit them. And to that point, around freeing up their time, much more time maybe spent on strategy, creative work, decision making, and really utilizing their time to better advantage.
Well, let's talk, Lawrence, maybe about specific type of jobs. And first one that comes to mind for me is, say, for accountancy, for example, right? Okay. And finance directors and finance people and businesses. I'm a partially qualified accountant. I like to joke because I did a BCom. I'd say my exemptions have long expired in relation to doing exams, but I never finished out. But, you know, I would have an idea of what I would have thought that an accountant would be. And then over the years, other things would have come in that an accountant would have to be proficient in using Excel sheets and various other parts of technology. But what other things are accountants, for example, going to have to do now because of AI? And again, to continue to be relevant rather than making themselves redundant.
I also am a partially qualified accountant because I also did a BCom. I might have kept my training a bit more up to date because I've also over the years managed finance ERP systems. So I've put in Oracle SAP and, you know, big finance systems like that. So I have a good level of familiarity with kind of what finance teams do, type of objectives that a finance director would have, and so on. Your kind of routine bookkeeping elements, as it would classically have been called, they've largely been automated years ago. So once upon a time, when my student holidays, the bookkeeping, there were massive big ledgers where people were still writing in
transactions. The drudgery.
That was a real skill, because nobody else really knew how that worked, right? If you go far back in time, I'm going to go off tangent here, but Henry Ford, the first, who was no fan of bean counters, as he called them, he had so little resources given to his finance team, they used to tot up purchase invoices by weighing them. Okay, so there's a different story maybe to go on that. So the type of routine things that finance teams look at, you know, they have approval processes, you know, around, was a purchase order approved? Did what I get? You know, they've all been automated over time, or significantly automated. They're scanning in of invoices and matching to see, you know, is that matching kind of what I ordered? That's been a significant amount. Still some exceptions that somebody needs to look at. There's been other processes to do with a lovely term called accruals, right? Where you're making allowance for what's due this month, what's due next month. A lot of that can be significantly done. And then in terms of budgeting and forecasting, as Bruno said, looking at, you know, what's been here, if I want to model around, you know, well, if our sales price is going to go up or if our cost of input's going to go up, you can now start to put energy towards that, but you can do a first cut at modeling what that might be and take away a lot of the effort of somebody trying to work all this stuff in a spreadsheet. So ultimately, you know, as a chief financial officer has a number of responsibilities. There's the fiduciary one, that the accounts reflect accurately, you know, what has happened, okay? But the more strategic one is around steering the business and providing advice to the wider senior team around sources of capital, investment decisions, appraising, is this a good investment? Where should we go? What longer-term planning in terms of source of funding are? So it ultimately frees up the CFO's team to help provide an input into that. And I think that ultimately is a very valuable thing, because you still need financial numeracy to understand the stuff. You would still need to have a good financial controller to review all of the accruals, to make sure that going into an audit, you're happy, you're in good shape and everything like that. And to make some decisions around, do we need to write off this amount of stock or something like that, depending on kind of what your nature of business is.
But you still need a considerable degree of human oversight, don't you? Because I'm just thinking, for example, something that has become very well-known people because of the TV series, the dramatization of what happened in the post office in the UK, where you had so many people who had their lives destroyed because it was a belief that the computers were right and that the people were actually thieves, and it was the other way around.
Absolutely. And ultimately, you know, company financial statements, you know, the finance director has to sign off them. If you're a US quoted company, you've got a load of legislation called Sarbanes-Oxley. You know, again, that puts onus on key individuals who ultimately have to stand over it. Nobody's ever going to accept these accounts are signed off by ChatGPT or some AI type of engine. So, and then that cascade down, that person has to be confident they've got the level of control and oversight across their team.
And Lawrence, just to stay with you for a minute, but if bringing it on to something like law, legal services provided by solicitors, because there's even been stories in recent years of cases effectively been tried by generative AI, that you would literally feed all the information in relation to a dispute into a computer, which would look at all the various case law and assess the evidence and would make the decision rather than a judge or humans doing so.
There's been a couple of controversial things. First of all, law is a living thing. So there's always new legislation coming in. There's always been some element of space for judges to interpret where is the boundary of law, okay, and to bring kind of new applications in. And it might get appealed to higher courts and Supreme Court ultimately. But there's always been that element of, you know, looking to apply. And good legislation in some ways should have an element of a general context to it. Right? If it's very, very specific, it will get out of date quite quickly, okay? So I think the application for AI is more around things like discovery, you know, where you've got millions of documents you're trying to go through, you're trying to trace trail of emails, correspondence, and so on. It's got a really good input into areas like that. It can definitely do a trawl around relevant case law and other statute legislation and so on. I wouldn't feel comfortable to leave it to...
Okay, I'm probably there at Bronagh going for the exaggerated version that it would be an AI judge. But there are suggestions of things in the legal profession, as Lawrence has said, that maybe instead of having to go through emails individually looking for information, that you might sort of use generative AI looking for keywords and coming back. But is there not a danger that if you do that, you miss things? Because I've not, I'm working on another book at the moment. I'm doing a lot of research in relation to going back through old newspaper archives. The British newspaper archives are online, which is terrific. But I feel that I actually have to read all of these things myself rather than actually trusting AI to find what I need and potentially missing things or not spotting a different idea that comes by actually doing the search myself.
Yeah. And I think that's that form of utilization of, say, generative AI is one tool that you might use in an example like that as well. And I know we've mentioned before, and Lauren said, you have to be for sure, once you're getting the information out, you need to make sure that you understand it and that you agree with it and you know that it's true. I think that points back very much to ensuring that, for example, appropriate data quality, data governance is in place, and that you are sure that your data is accurate, it's timely, it's consistent, and that you know that the data going into what you're interpreting is appropriate. Data governance is also really important. You mentioned security, privacy, alignment with GDPR, for example. And the other element around utilising AI is you need to make sure that about your data integration. Data sits in many different places. So that example you mentioned might be one resource you may use for your research, but actually there may be others that you want to take into account as well. So data integration is really important.
So in other words, it's not your only source, but it can be an additional source to help you, if not necessarily as a shortcut, but actually you then can have more time to go off into other directions.
Absolutely.
Okay, another one that's trying, and ethics comes into this as well, because it just struck me as we're talking here about, say, for example, things like purchasing insurance, particularly health insurance or life cover and whatever. How much is that now going to be influencing the pricing of it, that companies running data about you, true models, and then pricing it on the basis that they think you're going to die at the age of 60 because of previous health conditions affecting members of your family, as an example.
Yeah. And I think they're two good examples of highly regulated industries as well. Certainly the EU AI Act focuses on ethical AI, responsible AI, making sure that our fundamental rights are protected. So ethical AI and responsible AI is a key focus area for businesses and their work practices to make sure it aligns with business values, it benefits society, and that there's no disadvantage for some of those elements that you mentioned as well. That's certainly accounted for in the Act around identification of unacceptable risk, high risk as well, whereas insurance and the likes will come into play there. And then there's also generative general purpose models. So that's where the Act and regulation will look to support those organisations by helping identify what needs to be classified in what way. Businesses for sure need to look to bring in compliance measures, risk management measures. There also may be a need to look at AI governance. So maybe an organisation may want to put together a committee that understands what AI has taken place, who has oversight of it, who has responsibility for it, and ultimately who's making the decisions at the end of the day for your businesses as well. So there's certainly some key factors around compliance, risk and governance that businesses need to be aware of when they're bringing in or utilising AI models. In for example, insurance, healthcare, education, all industries, really.
But it strikes me, and I don't want this podcast to sound as if we've been negative or scared of the possibilities, because it does strike me, Lawrence, there must be incredible potential in healthcare by using generative AI to assess all the data, to come closer to having cures or vaccines for particular types of illnesses.
There is.
You don't sound convinced.
There's a couple of things. This is maybe going back to the classical definition of AI or machine learning. There's big value around kind of working through combinations of drugs that might be applicable. And it doesn't mean that it's a drug that's then ready to go. Okay. But a huge amount of work historically has gone through different formulations of chemicals and what might give the potential to be a shortlist of medicines or drugs to start and to put into a clinical trial. Okay, so AI and machine learning has been fast tracking a lot of that. Okay, and you know, many ways the collaboration, but also the kind of technology went into the fast development of COVID vaccines. That, you know, AI played a role in that in terms of accelerating that. Okay. In a different context, my other son is a trainee doctor. Okay, so part of what he has when he is looking at his areas of interest, you know, one was radiology, and he's kind of steering away from radiology, and for two reasons. One, there's two parts. One is your classical radiology, you're reading X-rays, reading scans, and he believes that that ultimately is going to be largely replaced by AI. Now, he says the other part of radiology, which would be more interesting, is the role radiology has to play in assisting surgery. Now, I don't really understand much more than that, okay? But he sees a distinction there, and he sees, and in many ways, if you look at a lot of the scandals that we've had in health over the years between kind of a smear testing, screening being poor, a lot of that was because the actual people looking at it didn't do a great job, and then the controls that were on top of it were even worse, okay? Now, it's not to say that AI is going to completely remove the need for that, but it definitely gives the possibility to have a better level of outcomes and makes it easier then to focus in on, you know, potentially false negatives and double check those.
And if that's in medicines, is there not great opportunity perhaps in using generative AI to deal with administration to actually speed things up in relation? But that said, given the slowness with which we have brought administrative advances in technology into our healthcare system, what confidence can we have that generative AI will be used speedily in Ireland to bring us health benefits?
Well, maybe just to follow on that, I was talking to a different gentleman last week in a corporate governance context. He was telling me his daughter is a doctor in London. She spends 2 hours in the evening, she calls it her laptop time, typing up all her notes from the day. Right, so that's part of all the admin work. And, you know, he was saying to her, he had a kind of a voice recorder where he said he can speak into it, set of notes, it'll generate a transcript, then he can review it and go through it and fine tune it. So his view is that that would take a huge amount of her time out. And I'm sure anybody who has been to a doctor, they quite often use their phone to do a summary of the key messages. That gets emailed as, you know, a voice message to their assistant, whoever that means, who then has to listen to it and type.
Who isn't in the typing pool.
Who isn't in the typing pool, but does do a bunch of other things. But that ultimately would be given that opportunity. But there would be a load of regulation that would need to be in place to have a level of confidence in the quality of that. Okay, Ireland isn't there yet. Hopefully it'll go that direction sooner rather than later. But, you know, you would want to have a level of confidence that your doctor's notes and transcription actually get turned into the right prescription. Because, you know, one of the key roles of a pharmacist is being able to read doctor's bad handwriting. You know, you want to make sure that your Gen AI engine transcribes their notes accurately, and you don't end up with a kind of a wrong prescription or a wrong treatment course being transcribed by a tool that isn't what the doctor intended.
I think as well, there's huge ambition in Ireland as well around healthcare and all the other industries as well. And we do see examples of organisations, public sector organisations as well, utilising AI to best advantage. Healthcare is a really good example. A key challenge will be consolidating all the data in one place, so that you can use that information for diagnostics, for example, and then the medical professionals can really check that and make sure the treatment plans, for example, are personalised, or there's next stage decision making made from that as well. I think Ireland as a country, though, has huge ambition. It's a really positive place to practice AI. There's a really good ecosystem here as well. The National AI Strategy sets out the government principles around that as well. And there are some really good examples, I think, happening. Yes, there's definitely a way to go, but certainly the collective ambition is to advance that to best advantage of society.
Another one's just come to mind, which I wouldn't have mentioned to you in advance of this, but you probably are aware of. I mean, for example, when it comes to autonomous driving, that is very much based on artificial intelligence, bringing together information, then applying it in real time to make sure the cars don't collide with each other. And I would have been very hopeful a few years ago that I would be able to spend my later years in a driverless car bringing me everywhere that I needed to go. It all seems to have slowed up in relation to the development. And then we had a piece on The Last Word recently with one of our tech correspondents, Elaine Byrne, who'd been in a driverless taxi in San Francisco recently, telling us about the experience of being on your own in a car, having no control over the steering wheel and what it was like to go around hitting, I think, a maximum 40 miles per hour in the traffic in San Francisco. But she did say that still the stats suggest that when you look at the number of crashes that these cars have had as against those with human drivers, they're involved in more crashes than those with human drivers, which came as a surprise, because I would have thought a lot of the time the human driver is going to be more dangerous to you necessarily than the automation. Is that just simply a matter of that when everything gets automated, when you have scale and everyone's in driverless cars, that they become safer rather than when they're interacting with the real world at present?
I think that's an interesting one for sure. And there's definitely a lot involved around psychology and decision-making in autonomous driving as well. And I think that's one to watch.
It's a complex environment that an autonomous car is operating in. You know, I mean, trains over the years, there's been terrible tragedies with, you know, signaling, errors with signaling, right? But it's a simpler, you know, system you're operating within, by and large, okay, in terms of tracking stuff. You know, there's not as many trains, the number of routes that they can operate on, you know, by definition is much more constrained. Your autonomous car, you know, there's nothing to stop a person walking out in the road that you don't expect, you know, an animal. You've got other cars that aren't driven, you know, automatically as well. So there's a lot of variables. It's funny, consolation, Matt, you're young yet, so there's lots of time to go, right? Okay. It's a big ambition to go that route, okay? Will it be there? How fast? I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I would have a level of, I suppose, anxiety sitting in a car with nobody else controlling it and feeling a little bit powerless, right? But, you know, maybe we all feel a bit like that when we get into an airplane as well and we're dependent on the two people up front and hopeful that...
Who a lot of the time are dependent on their computers and on their technology.
Correct.
And AI often been involved in their traffic control and whatever.
Correct. Yeah. And most of the time it works really, really well. Okay. So, you know, I'd be optimistic that longer term it's going to get to a point where it's very reliable and safe, but it's...
Bron, an awful lot of the changes that we've had in the last couple of centuries in relation to workplace, technology tends to have focused on replacing manual labor to make things easier physically, perhaps, for people. Some of the fears that a lot of professionals are expressing now is that when you go back to what we said earlier with Lawrence was telling us about the SIA belief that jobs would change, a lot of it is what might be called more intellectual jobs or office-based jobs and the rest of it. Mm. Do those people who've developed professional qualifications have more to fear from AI, generative AI, than those in manual professions?
I think my own personal view would be very much there's much more of an opportunity. And I know that it's always a lot, it's really easy to, you know, remember all the negative stories and the big stories. But I think there's so much opportunity here. And demystification, education, literacy, you know, I'm really passionate about that, is help people understand the benefits. Because I guess some of the news stories that there may be, it's going to replace jobs, but rather it's helping you automate tasks that take you a long time to do, to make sure you free up your time to do value-added tasks. And I think that's the key. And helping those professions understand what that looks like is really important, and how this technology can be utilised as a positive thing rather than something that's going to take away.
And I suppose many people listening will have been involved in what's called continuous professional development throughout their career, or lifelong learning. Yeah. This is just another element of that, isn't it?
Very much so. And I suppose maybe in context of a fear, this famous economist, John Maynard Keynes, I'm sure you've heard of him, in 1930, it was kind of like came out of an after-dinner conversation, and then he wrote it up as a paper. But he speculated that, you know, projecting the current technology trends and so on, that in 100 years' time, by 2030, so we're not that far off of it, people would only work 15 hours a week. And then he said the big challenge will be, well, what are we going to do with our leisure? So very few of us...
We've come nowhere near that.
We're nowhere near that.
If anything, people particularly in professional jobs are working longer and longer hours, although younger people are rebelling against that.
Correct. But if you look at, we say, if you take the same... Well, first of all, we have worked in so far as 1930 was probably a six-day week or at least a five-and-a-half-day week, okay? The level of productivity that you're getting out of that is like multiple of times to what it was in the 1930s and so on. So... But if you look at what's different now, there's a different type of role. And, you know, as technology has developed and as our capabilities developed, it's essentially created new demand as well for different types of services. So some of the services that we have people doing now, nobody could have anticipated them 20 years ago, never mind 100 years ago. You know, and, you know, the entire world and industry that's built around a mobile phone. Nobody could have conceived of that when we all had our little Nokias playing a game of Snake on it and there wasn't anything else happening on it. And then go back earlier than that when we had a landline.
And actually, do you expect AI to, or generative AI and AI, our use of them to intensify the more they're put into our phones rather than perhaps for a lot of people doing it at the moment off a desktop or off a laptop?
Well, there's a lot of AI in your phone already.
Yeah, but aren't the phone makers promising an awful lot more, though?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I mean, your camera has got a lot of AI in it. You know, all your email has a lot of AI in it. Your Google Maps and your traveling around the place has a lot of AI in it. Probably, you know, all of the, you know, gadgets like smartwatches and everything in terms of understanding your sleep patterns and everything like that, that's gathering a mass amount of data and information, and it's giving you proposals around what you should do, right? Get up and walk, Lawrence, you've been sitting down for far too long. So, you know, there's definitely, and, you know, the mobile phone, until such time as it's replaced by another piece of technology where you don't have to physically carry something, you know, it's the center of so many people's world today in terms of all of their work. Emails on it, communications on it, reference data is on it. So absolutely, that's a key area for further AI investment.
To finish, though, can I ask each of you to sort of sum up sort of where you think we're going, and particularly with an emphasis on the workplace for people and for businesses as to the changes which are coming and what businesses and employees have to do to ready themselves for what is, I presume, inevitable at this stage?
I think from my experience, both in industry and with my involvement in CEDAR, I see huge potential out there and also huge want to get involved. So for example, in a previous role, myself and my team rolled out a data academy, and that was a graduated pathway of learning across all levels in the organization. And our program was oversubscribed 4 to 5 times. So
people wanted to get involved.
They wanted to understand more. They want to be trained. They want to understand how to utilize this technology to help. So rather than seeing, you know, the negative elements, my experience is that people are ambitious, they're excited, they're enthused, and they want to understand how they can use it to best advantage to their roles in the organization. The key is helping people bridge the gap and help the literacy piece as well. So that's my experience. And actually the level of demand coming in, as Lauren said as well, one of the key challenges is prioritizing where to start. And deciding which use case to start first, second, third, and also where to place your resources in terms of your technology, your data, and your people. So that's where I see it. I see a huge opportunity and a huge want and need to get involved in this as well.
And Bronagh, you mentioned regulation earlier. I'm keeping that for another episode because we have people very much involved in regulation who I want to bring in on that. And it is fascinating to see what's going on at EU level, because the EU is taking a very different approach to what America and the rest of the world is doing as to allowing companies, I suppose, the freedom to do as they want.
Yeah.
Lawrence, I'll leave the last word to you. So what do you think?
Maybe 3 points. One we've touched on earlier is... start small with a structured roadmap to make progress, okay? 2, you need to invest in your people and just manage the change, and that'll be upskilling them and then bringing them on a journey that they're comfortable with what it means. And then 3, for your inner accountant, Matt, and any accountants, Gen AI will not replace an accountant, but an accountant with Gen AI will replace an accountant without Gen AI. And for accountants, you can put any other profession into those brackets.
Lawrence Fessy, Brona Reardon, thank you both so much for being with us. That has been absolutely fascinating. And I know an awful lot more about AI as a result of that and Gen AI, and would be a lot more confident about being able to cope and deal with it. That's it for this episode of AI Magnified. Again, thanks to all my guests. If you enjoyed our discussion about AI, well, you can join us for a special AI Magnified panel event in association with Fitzgerald Power and AIB on the 14th of November. You can hear from SME leaders on how AI is transforming business operations. Register your interest at fitzgeraldpower.ie/AI event. This series proudly sponsored by Fitzgerald Power. More than just accountants, Fitzgerald Power is a trusted partner for its clients. The firm is committed to empowering businesses with deeper financial insights, helping them make strategic, informed decisions. And we will have more over the next 2 weeks. So we hope you join us then.
AI Magnified, brought to you by Go Loud and proudly sponsored by Fitzgerald Power. Adding value always. FitzgeraldPower.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.